thing about this show is that only I can hear the music playing. Hello. I am joining you for a new episode of Hot Fix, the sub-show of Breaking Change, where there's more than one person on it. Today, I'm joined by Jose Valim. I've known of Jose for 15, 16 years. I first knew of him as the person who... I've always thought of him as a visionary because he was the first person in the Ruby and Rails community who could see coming that like computers and servers were going to have more than one CPU core in them. And so we should take multi-threading seriously. And then he did the Lord's work of making so many aspects of Ruby and Rails thread safe so that we could host them on multiple servers simultaneously safely. Not content there, went on to start a programming language called Elixir, which ruined a lot of Ruby developers, and now they insist on only ever using Elixir, including, frustratingly for me, my brother Jeremy, who's dyed-in-the-wool Elixir snob and refuses to ever pair with me in Ruby anymore. But I'm not bitter. Today, Jose's got a company called Dashbit and just announced a new agentic coding tool called Tidewave that I'm sure will come up at various bits in the conversation. But this is not a hype show. It's not an interview show. This is a show where I try to get my guests to say something that could get them fired by riling them up about something. And so everyone has to come with a problem statement. And Jose, you tell me you got something that you're worked up about.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I'm worked up about is that... we actually have no idea where we are doing or where we are going with coding agents. There are a lot of people, there are a lot of doomers and gloomers who like to say, we're not going to have programmers in 2 years or 3 years from now. I think it was even somebody pretty high at Anthropic said more than 6 months ago that in 6 months, AI will be writing 90% of the code, and that, of course, didn't happen. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of speculation and guessing, and that is happening while we still have so many unanswered questions and problems to solve.
So, if it's not 90%, what would you guess is the percentage of code today being written by AI?
Oh, guessing.
Unless you got hard data, I don't know if you track analytics.
Yeah. No, I actually don't know. And there are a lot of good questions because we can ask like, so for example, I don't know. I could try to guess, but I think, yeah. Like, so for example, like, so some time ago, like GitHub, they came with a report from their autocomplete thing, which was one of the first things that we started using AI for development. And then it said that like, oh, you know, like AI is writing like a high amount of the code because of the auto completion thing. But for me, I'm like, well, that's how many times it was accepted, but how many times it wasn't accepted? Like, that's what I want to know. Right. So if you say like, well, how much code is being written by AI? I think that's a good question. But for me, the immediate follow up questions would be, well, how much code AI is writing and you're not merging it? And I think Meta had a recent study where like they accepted only 25% of the pull requests written by agents, which for me, it's like not acceptable because it means that 75% of the time I am going and reviewing code and doing work that is not going anywhere, is not leading to something being merged, right? So I think we like to talk a lot about like the acceptance rates, and I want to read like the
refusal rate. Well, and that's the funny thing is like, you know, and I've commented on this exact same thing before where GitHub puts out saying, well, 90% of our spicy autocomplete suggestions are accepted. And I'm like, no, all that means is that when programmers see, you know, italicized grayed out text automatically in front of them, they'll hit tab. So it's like all it means is people hit tab, and then what's happening 90% of the time is either right away or very slowly they delete all of it because it's wrong. And you're not tracking that number of like the oopsie, I guess this is, because we've been trained as programmers for, I don't know, 3 decades now, that when you see a tab completion, it means it's a reference to a known reference to real code. Like, oh, it's a method completion, or, oh, this is like the next parameter that this function takes. And so we've been trained over the course of our careers to just trust it. And now we've had to unlearn that, because all the AI generated stuff is just from an LLM and it's not as reliable. But like, you know, to your point, I think there's another cleavage here where some, you know, and of course, Microsoft and Meta and all that, well, Microsoft and GitHub, which is also Microsoft, they're incentivized to like maximize that number to make it sound like it's like really, really high. Anthropic, the same thing too, of course. So they got a perverse incentive to like try to claim that it's amazing when it's not. But at the same time, you've got other people who are just generally tech optimists who would tell you like, hey, well, if 25% of the pull requests are accepted, that's actually really good, because a programmer costs way more than 4 times more than a GPT Pro or a Claude Max plan. And it, because it can hustle 24 hours a day, like maybe in the time it would take to get one pull request out of a $150,000 programmer salary, you know, you'd get 20, 30, 40 pull requests. And so even if you're only accepting 25%, it's still, you know, worth it. I'm not saying that, but some people say that.
Yeah. Yeah, which I mean, it's like, yeah, but now you have that person reviewing code most of the time, right? And then there are a bunch of like implications on that. Like, are you as a developer, is that what you want to be your new responsibility right now? And sometimes, and I mean, like, I would say that that's probably at least, I think if you go to, like, to my GitHub stats, I think that's kind of like half of my responsibility. I spend like half of my time reviewing code, and I think I enjoy it. I think I'm happy reviewing code from like from pull requests that people that I don't know submit to my projects or from inside the company. But if that grows to 70%, 80%, like how happy am I going to be with that relationship? And I'm not sure. And usually, like a lot of the times, like the pull requests we have at work, we are already aligned, right, on what we are working on and what we are delivering. And you know, so it's going to have a high acceptance rate. But if I'm reviewing code that ultimately is not merged, I'm going to start feeling that my work's not productive or I'm not being useful, and how that's going to impact me.
Yeah, you know, like to be totally honest, one of the reasons I like to work solo is I hate fucking reviewing code. One of the reasons I'm glad that like none of my open source ever got as famous as any of your open source is because I actually don't want other people giving me fly by night pull requests that are poorly shaped, that require a lot of feedback. Because like the biggest reason for me is that I don't like reading and I'm too impatient. But the second biggest reason is that I don't like trying to protect people's feelings by, you know, thanking them for their unsolicited, you know, code that does something that I don't care about. And then having to like carefully walk through like, this is how we format stuff and stuff, you know, like, because I just can't bring myself to be really blunt with people and say, no, sorry, we don't want this. Because I don't want to hurt people's feelings. I'm better about that now. I've gotten a lot better at hurting people's feelings through practice. but with the AI tools, I was telling Becky just the other day, one thing that frustrates me is that they have a lot of human behavior is the wrong word. I realize they're not human. But for example, I had an incident where I was asking AI to identify cases of a particular like unsafe call in the code base. And I'd identified this in a couple places, but it wasn't easy to grep for. And so I said, okay, find all the incidents and fix them. And then I'll check in my Git diff like that you got them all. And it found 2. And I knew that there were more than 2. And so what I said was, for every one you find, I will give you 2 high fives. And then it came back with 30 correctly found. And after each citation, it put up the double high five emoji twice. And so sure enough, I was like, well, I promised it. And so here I'm writing like 60 high five emojis into my Codex CLI. And then it's like, yeah, motherfucker. Like, it's super excited. And I'm like, God damn it. You know, like, I, here I am having to mollycoddle a computer to get it to do what I want. And to your point, when I talk to like mutual friends of ours, like Aaron Patterson, like he likes to program for the programming, and he, you know, isn't interested in just becoming a full-time reviewer. I think that's just not what he signed up for. And I think that's where a lot of the frustration comes from.
Yeah. So that's interesting because I feel I am at a point, I mean, I enjoy programming, obviously. But for me, the problem solving is the most exciting part. And I am at a point where most of the time I can write the software in my head. So it's like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, there is this problem. I want to implement this thing. I can visualize all the pieces, how they connect, right? What they are going to do, right? So to me, like the writing the code many, many times is just a brain dump, right? I already have it in my head. I just need to write it all down. So I'm kind of happy that the LLMs can help me with that because that's no longer the most exciting part of the process for me. And that's why I am very excited about things like performance or benchmarking, right? Like somebody says, hey, something is slow because that's the part where I can code and I don't know what is going to happen. There is suspense. I have like to think out of the box, to measure out of the box, to think about approaches that are not going to be the first thing that come to my mind. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, that, you know, some people like to code. Some people like the problem solving. What I find is that I like the problem to have been solved. Like, I don't actually like the problem solving. I have a kind of brain probably like you that will stay up at night kind of asynchronously solving stuff in my head, but I'd much rather be playing video games or thinking about anything else or just relaxing. The goal for me is to have the thing built. And as a result, you know, because I don't like reviewing code, I'm kind of in this uncanny valley right now with these tools. Like, if I'm in Cursor and I'm in a shared IDE environment where, you know, I can write code, I can enjoy liking writing code. Like, I can play some music and I can get into the groove, and I'm not as smart as you. So I'm not like this Hemingway who can just like write, you know, like perfectly positioned code, like right out the gate usually, but I can get into that flow. And I can't get into that flow with like a sidebar agent running 100 miles an hour every time I ask it to do something and then me try to play catch up. That's exhausting to me. But I can, very like, you know, if I'm in one of the terminal tools, kind of just tell it what I want to do in English, check a diff every half hour or something like that, and then get on top of it. And rather than just merge everything mindlessly, all right, well, here's 4 more bullet points or here's 5 more bullet points. And until it's resolved all of the grievances that I have, I'm not going to merge it. And then I'll commit and then I'll push. And that workflow is the best I've found. But to be completely honest with you, what ends up happening is I'm like, I've had to type the exact same complaint 500 times. I've had to write a paragraph saying, hey, you know, when you like Codex does this a lot. When you delete something or when you move something, don't leave the old file with a comment saying old code used to be here. Don't like, if you delete a method, don't say like, I removed this here. Right. It's because in the system prompt, it says like, make sure everything's back upable and you're not doing anything destructive, even though you have Git and it's totally safe. And no amount of me putting, you know, agents.md prompting Git stops it from doing that. That's just like one example of 20 of like, all right, you know, I want zero argument constructors on every class. And it's like, oh, guess what you did again? Like all of these sorts of issues. And so now I'm in this place where I'm like, what's my next step? Do I write a series of text expanders so that I can just very tersely type out the exact same feedback over and over again? I'm kind of curious what your workflow looks like and whether you've got any advice for me.
So my workflow is so there are a couple of things that I do, which is I very rarely ask the agent to fix anything. So I'm like, hey, build this thing. And but I think it's worth saying that I don't send it like to build like very massive things. I don't like, hey, build this whole system for me and then I come back, right? Because as I was saying, I usually can break things apart. So I can kind of give it like, hey, build this part, and then tell it to connect at the end. So, but I ask it to build something. And then if it's like, let's say it has to be 70% good. If it's less than 70% good, I just start over again. And I say, hey, you're going to do this. And, but don't do that. Don't do that. And do this instead. So that's something that I like to do a lot, because people say like there's this spiral of doom, like when it does something wrong, because the thing that it did wrong is there in the context, it has the tendency of doing that again. Something that I see happening a lot of times is that when I am more like on prototype stage, so I'm using it like for Tidewave, something that I really like about AI is just to build throwaway things, prototype to validate new features or new ideas or new frameworks. So it's very funny that sometimes I just let it go. I don't care about code quality nor anything. I just want to see something working. Then when it gets stuck, something, it's like, oh, I did a mistake. And then it's like, okay, I'll try to fix this mistake. And then it tries the second time, doesn't work. Try a third time. The fourth time is usually the first one. It just goes back and then it gets into the loop, right? So I like to start fresh very frequently. And I don't use it like to fix the code at some point. Like I'd like, hey, at this line, this doesn't look right. And then I just go and change it. And then I say, I did some changes, read files again, continue. So
I'm going to stop you right there. If you're listening to this and you're a coder and you do that kind of thing, like anytime you have the agent write for you, and then you go in and fix the one line and you don't go back and tell the agent that you just changed the code, its next change is very likely just going to use some cached copy of what it remembers about that file and then overwrite your fixes. Pro tip. So you have to come back to, and like, again, just like with the high five thing, treat them like a human. Like if you were pairing with somebody and they went to lunch and then you changed a bunch of shit, you would tell the pair programmer like, hey, just so you know, I went in and mucked with this stuff. If you don't tell it that, you're just going to have it roll back everything that you just did.
Yeah. So it's funny because most of the agents, they now have a check. They're like, if they try to write to a file and that file has changed after it last wrote or read that file, it actually checks and asks the agent to read it again. So that problem is allegedly solved, but the issue is that the agent doesn't know that you were the one who changed it and you wanted it to have changed. So it just goes, the end result is the same. It just goes and override it anyway. It's just like, this change was supposed to be here.
Yeah, and it just uses more, uses more tokens to reason about, huh, boy, am I stupid? I thought, yeah, I did it this way. Like it's better my way. No, I'm going to.
Yeah. So there are a lot of those things, and then it's agents and this meant to solve those things. But if the prompt is saying that, hey, you are supposed to make everything backupable, maybe, and that's the other thing is also like you're using Codex, and I, in my experience, so there's this funny thing. So let me tell this story, and then I'll come back to the point, which is. So when we built Tidewave, the first one that it supported was Claude and Anthropic, okay? And it's a very stubborn model. Like you ask, like we say, so for example, if you read the prompt for like Claude code, it says like, you should be very concise. You should, be very succinct in your answers. Like keep things to 5 to 4 words. I think at some point it even says like one word answers is best. Like it's literally there. And when we did our prompt for Tidewave, we got some of that, right? and we put it there. So when GPT-5 was released, right, from OpenAI, we said, okay, let's try Tidewave with GPT-5. And it looked very weird because the model was like, it would do a good amount of work and then say, done. You would ask a question, it would say like, good or bad. And that's because then later we realized that those things that we were telling Claude, like, hey, give one answer is best, and it would 100% not listen to that. It would still finish the feature and say, here's what I did, and like dump this huge summary that like 95% of the time I never read or care about, right? It's still doing all that, but the GPT-5 one was actually better at listening the what you say, like, hey, you know, if you should not write code comments, it would be better at not writing code comments. So it's actually funny that even then, like, you're using Codex, which is probably using GPT-5 and GPT-5 Codex, you are asking things and then it just doesn't listen. And it's very funny, something also related to this, which is hilarious actually, is that Chris McCord, the creator of Phoenix, he gave it a nice name to this technique, which is that he injects promises. Because when you're implementing your coding agent, you and then you send, like, imagine you're having a conversation, right, with the coding agent, right, or whatever AI agent, you're having a conversation. They are the AI messages and they are the user messages, your messages. You can actually lie. You can say, hey, the AI said this. You can send whatever argument you want, right? You have control over that. So what he did is that to improve like the adherence to the prompt is that he has the prompt and then he injects a fake message with the AI saying, I promise that I'll not add unnecessary code comments. I promise that I'll not leave like leftover edits. I promise, like, so he injects a fake message as if the AI has promised a couple things, and then the user says, okay, now that you have promised all those things, you can now proceed with your work. And then he said that it improved a lot the adherence, like introducing a fake message as if AI had promised that.
It's literally like mind control. It's like the Jedi mind trick. Yeah. Is that maybe the best? It's like, oh no, these are not the comments you're looking for. You just covered a whole bunch of stuff, and I want to ping on a few of them. One is, you were correct, totally, in my opinion, that one of the hardest things to do is to, we've had to, as programmers, learn how to size work over the years. You know, usually we're thinking about thin vertical slices. We're thinking about features, like what'll take a human 2 or 3 days at most to work on. And so when we think about like, what's the right size of a user story or a feature or a Jira ticket or a GitHub issue, we're kind of anchored to think like that. But of course, in this new era where the tools can go a lot faster, but they also are less adherent, how we size the work needs to change, and everyone's just figuring it out as they go. So I'm curious, what's your approach to sizing the work? And like, do you prefer, it sounds like you prefer more horizontal over vertical slices, where you're kind of giving it very discrete tasks and then you're wiring it up only after the fact.
Yeah, so the way I think about this, so like, I hear some people saying like, oh, I let the like the agent code overnight and it sent like 30K lines of code per request. And then I'm like, you know, it's like, come on. Like, if anybody sends you like a 30K per request, like the thing...
The only correct response to that is the reply comment, did you just tell me to go fuck myself? Like, that's...
Right.
The only answer.
Right. It's like, come on, like, you know, break the code apart, right? Like, make, you know, like, figure out the how to make this into a smaller change. And maybe in some cases, it is like, anyway, right? Like, so like, you have to break. And maybe in some cases, like, yeah, it's going to be 30K at the end. Break it apart, make it into something that you can build part by part. Like, for me, like, that's kind of part of our job, right? Like, we, you know, somebody says like, hey, build a website, right? And then I have to figure out like what are the discrete steps on that, collect feedback over those things. At the moment, I'm just saying like, hey, you know, build the whole thing for me. And I do not understand like the design process, how things are organized, right? Like we basically gave up on our responsibility as software engineers or whatever, right? So that's kind of the metric that I like to go is like, look, if I send this as a pull request, will people curse me, right? Like, will people, right? Like, will people say like, okay, this is something doable, this is something that I can review, or this is getting a little bit out of control. And then, look, if you want to do the 30K one, do like, fine, like do a prototype. Have the agent like do the whole thing, and then they're like, okay, that's the whole thing. Now, summarize what are the changes that you did, the main steps, and break that into I don't know, like a bunch of guides or a bunch of steps, milestones that should be implemented, so I can implement this gradually where I understand all of the pieces, because there is no other way where you're getting 30k lines of code and saying and reviewing that and finding all the flaws, all the bugs. So my answer would be it needs to be something reviewable, right? This should be something where you're going to look at the end of it and you're going to say, okay, yeah, I can review this and not feel like completely drained and exhausted, because then you are just like shooting yourself in the foot. You're asking the thing to generate thing that you know is going to upset you.
You are, of course, correct, but you and I are probably different in that, you know, not only are we more experienced, but we give a shit about like the quality of the work and the long-term prospects of our ability to maintain it, and you know, whether it's fit for purpose and how great the software is to use and so on and so forth. Like, we have strong opinions about how things should be. I suspect that for the vast majority of people out there, like of teams out there, there are team members who are happy to just get that 30,000 pull request, hit merge, and then deal with the consequences. So like a lot of, like a phenomenon we've seen is people complaining that models are getting dumber over time. And it's true that like Claude did get dumber over this summer and Anthropic finally, you know, admitted that. But it's also true that if you started a project and you're just vibe coding, which I guess maybe like the best definition for vibe coding is code that's generated by agents, but not reviewed, not like read, sort of like how Michael Feather's definition of legacy code is like code without tests. It's if you go down that route, once you break that threshold and you start merging in code that you haven't reviewed closely and improved and tweaked and refactored, whether you're having the agent do the review and the refactor or not doesn't really matter. Like, you're going to be building up so much technical debt that eventually the code base will be so inconsistent and so naughty that like there's no way to give further instructions that are not inherently contradictory, because the code is now saying multiple different things that are contradictory. So you say, oh, just add this one more feature. And it's like, well, it turns out that you've got three different competing Tailwind CSS helpers and this other like, you know, CSS crap that was like copied in over here. And then you've got JavaScript that's like adjusting style attributes. And so there's actually no way to actually follow the user's instructions anymore. And so it ends up doing things the user doesn't like. And they're like, oh, look, it got dumber. When in reality, no, that's just entropy. That's just the system breaking down because it hasn't been reviewed. And I suspect that's what a lot of teams are seeing. And when you hear people say, oh, well, all this AI stuff is hogwash, or the models are getting dumber, or it's not really usable on big production systems, I think that is probably a big contributing factor.
Right. Yeah. I think so. For me, it's very hard for me to like put myself into that situation, because it's not a situation I would put myself in. So, you know, it's like even going back, right? We can say, well, in the past, people would write code. I mean, still today is not a past thing, without tests, right? And that's not a situation I would put myself in as well. So if you wanna get rid of like software engineering principles or techniques or process, whatever you want to call it, like code reviews, stats, of course you can do that. But then you know, the price has to be paid at some point. And, you know, so for me, like, it's like the classic, like, doctor joke, right? Like, it hurts when I do this, and then it's like, well, don't do that, right? So that's kind of how I would answer those things. But something that it's very, like, I heard something very interesting today in a Brazilian podcast, Elixir in Focus. So they had a professor saying, one of the things that he said that was, it's kind of obvious after somebody says it, is that we think about all those things in the software engineering process, like, oh, we write tests, right? We produce code, we produce a lot of things, we produce artifacts, documentation. But one of the things that when we are doing a software engineering process, when we are working on a feature, we also gain knowledge. And I think that's kind of essential to what you are saying, right? Like, you gain knowledge of how the system is architected, where the features live, right? How we are designing things on the system, right? And then the agents, they're not capable of retaining this knowledge yet. Maybe they're going to get better with this in the future, right? It's something that people are talking a lot about now, about context engineering. And one of the part of context engineering is exactly memory, right? How the agents can retain things, right? But when you were describing those things, I was thinking about that. Yeah, like, you know, even if a project is messy, right? And people are like not writing tests, there's still knowledge. You're still gaining knowledge somehow for everything,
right? Because otherwise the humans would think like that they wouldn't think that they're being better than the agents. They know they're better than the agents because they know how to navigate the twisty, you know, riverbed and the whitewater rapids that of their code base. And the agent, maybe they can teach the agent once, but like, you're not, the amount of forensic necessary every time you type /new and you start a fresh chat, like, is so much work, and that work only gets bigger. So like, without that memory, without that guide, without that roadmap, and if you're just vibe coding, after a certain point, you also lose that roadmap because you as the human lose that knowledge.
Yeah, and then people are like, okay, I know what we're going to do. We are going to have the agent write documentation and write memories and maintain all those things. And then I'm like, now it's like, okay, now you are producing all those things, but who is now is responsible for guaranteeing that those things remain up to date and accurate, right? So a lot of the times, like, we are trying AI tooling, and then we're like, oh, AI tooling is not doing this correct thing. And we're saying, I know what is the answer. I'm going to ask AI to generate more things. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's going to be the answer that we want.
You're 100% right. Like I, over the summer, I tried doing kind of spec-driven development in my code base, where I would, and this is before that had a name, but I was, you know, like, basically writing out tasks in text files. Every task came with a plan, kind of like how people use architectural review decision documents or whatever those are called, ADRs. It doesn't matter. Like, I was documenting it all in the repo. But then the problem was, of course, a month later, I would see the agent make really, really strange choices. And I realized it was loading into context a whole bunch of either outdated tasks or outdated documents. And part of the reason why, even though it's nice for the LLM to have code comments explaining why things are where they are, how many years have we been talking about, decades have we been talking about, that code comments eventually lie to you, like, because they are not executable, because there's nothing verifying that they're correct, eventually they will fall out of sync. And so now you've got comments that disagree with the code, and all of that's getting poisoning the context. And so the only source of truth has to be executable and has to be verifiable. And we're at a point now where the agents don't have memory. The context that we're feeding them, like, these documents are out of date. The code comments are wrong. Just like humans know to ignore those code comments, but the LLM can't. And once it gets in there, so I want to switch gears for just a second, because you mentioned something that is, as a human, is really hard for me, and it's really hard for me to unlearn, which is, if I've got this robot who can write code at 200 words per minute, that I can parallelize across multiple work trees, that can just relentlessly work for 24 hours a day, intellectually, I know that like when it does something that's only 70% good, I could just have it do that 10 different times and pick my favorite, or I could just blow it all up, delete it, and very cheaply have it try again. But I've been so trained to treat code like an asset and to treat the work as being valuable because it's time consuming and maybe somebody, quote unquote, put a lot of effort into it, that I've got to go beat the ugly out of it and make it good enough, that it's very difficult for me just to get reset hard and tell it, nope, do it again, or start a fresh chat and just roll the stochastic dice and hope that the next one is better. What's your relationship with blowing it up been, and how's that changed with agents?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly it, right? And that's the one of the positive things about agents is that, like, if somebody sends me a 1,000 lines of code PR and then I'm like, this is the wrong way to go, That's kind of like tough news to deliver, right? You have to say, oh, you know, like, but if the agent, I can just git reset hard. There are like no hurt feelings. And you're exactly, and that's something that I tell people, like that relationship, like we're not used with deleting code or not deleting code in the sense more like discarding code that is produced. And that's something that we do have to rewire our brain. But the other thing is that I think like, the fact that we see like so much, I don't know how to say this. So I'll just do the long version and then maybe you help me do the summary, which is like, we exaggerate things. Like people say like, oh, you know, like I am 3 times more productive with coding agents, right? Which for me, it's like, it's kind of silly, because if you are 30%, if we can get to a point where we say, look, we are 30% more productive with coding agents, that's already huge. That's already like enough to cause like big impact in the industry, right? So we are all going like for those big numbers, like, oh, you know, 3 times, 4 times. Like, no, like 30% is like a big difference. There is going to be like a big impact that we're going to have. Like, you know, maybe a team now can be smaller and all those sort of things, and how that's going to affect our software development process. If, you know, if you have an existing team that is producing 33% more, like it changes things sufficiently. And that's the same thing, like when I think about the 70%, like I am completely happy with it, like not being perfect, with it not being like 100% there. Right? Like, can you be like 80% good? Perfect. Like, I can do the rest, right? Especially if the rest is the parts of software that I find interesting, right? And then it's like, oh, perfect. I can do the fun part now, right? Like, automate the boring ones.
Yeah, I used to do a lot of, because I started a company called Test Double, I would get hired to do a lot of help for QA and quality engineering folks who are writing a lot of end-to-end integration tests, whether in like Selenium or even older tools. And one of the things that I tried to get people to focus on was to reserve the manual testing for the things that like actually you care a great deal about, and then to automate the drudgery. So if you just start that way and you just start automating away the drudgery, it's like the famous economist Keynes, like Keynesian economics was like, oh, well, we're going to have these huge productivity gains. And so people are going to work 3 days a week or 2 days a week or something. And then, of course, what we did was work just expands to fill its container. And so now people just do a lot of bullshit and, you know, fill it with emails and meetings and whatnot. And I think that we have a sort of similar hang up with all of this automation. It's like, well, I can do so much more. So now, and if you look at like the Claude subreddit over the summer, you almost saw this, not like a mental illness, but this anti-pattern kept emerging in humans over and over again, where they felt like, I pay for this subscription for basically unlimited coding time. And so it would be wasteful to not be fully saturating it constantly. And so one person wrote a post that they were switching, and somebody wrote into my podcast suggesting that I do this. They were switching to a polyphasic sleep schedule around the 5-hour limit so that they could, go to sleep, wake up, and feed the agent more crap and then go about their business, and then once they're only sleep during the parts where it's off, so you could keep that thing fed. Like that's where you could take this, right? And I think some people at the extremes are, but when you talk about like that person, when they say that they're getting a 3x or a 10x speed up or productivity boost, and then you look at marketing material and it's talking about a 3x or 10x productivity boost, I think that they're talking about fundamentally different things, because that person is seeing it from like a genuine, how many lines of code are getting written in practice, good or bad, that reserve judgment. What the company's marketing is saying is, our investors just gave us, call it $100 to $150 billion of investment, more investment than anyone got in the 2010s. And in order for that investment, they just have to back into a number that would make that investment pay off for their investors. And so if we've collected $500 billion in funding, 30% is never going to see a return on our investors' money. And so if we wrote that down, we would actually like be in huge trouble. It has to be 10x, it has to be 20x, it has to change the world. And people are aware of this, and so then the AI skeptics point to that anyone saying 3x, 5x, regardless if we're talking about the guy who's not sleeping anymore, or we're talking about the bullshit marketing, they're like, see, you know, like it's all just made up, it's all just corporate bullshit. And I think your approach of being pragmatic and being honest with people is kind of just out of step with the zeitgeist right now. It's like not a lot of people are talking like you are in terms of like what you should be able to expect.
Yeah, it's and it's funny because it does makes me think, like, you know, am I missing something, right? Like, which I can be. I don't rule that out at all, right? Like, I can be missing something, and we can be getting close to 2x or 3x, but I consider myself like a fairly advanced use of AI. You know, I use it, and not only advanced, but like I use it extensively. And for example, I have the Claude Pro, like I don't have like the Max one. And even using it somewhat, I have to do a caveat on that, but even use it somewhat like extensively, and not only for like for coding, but like for discussions and so on, I only hit the limit once or twice over the next, like, and that's on the Pro one, right? Which makes me think like maybe I'm not using that extensively. But the caveats that I also use Zed, and I also pay for the Zed plan. So there is that. So I kind of counting on two.
You know, there's another, I want to take this in a direction of, because I don't know how much time we necessarily have, and I want to get back to your core problem. We're dancing around, you know, the problem statement that you gave us, which is really, yes, that like nobody has any idea where all this shit's going. And I think that there's kind of two interesting facets of that problem, if we're going to apply a hot fix and say this is the solution. One is, and I think previous hotfix interviews has kind of covered this, is like, we should all be more humble. We should, give things a try earnestly, and keep an open mind. But I think another side, and this is like, I wanted to talk to you, not only because you're a good git, as a fellow, you're a fellow programming language designer. I also designed a programming language called Emo Ruby in 2015, which, or maybe 2014, which was a trans, it was back in the era of CoffeeScript, which just transpiled JavaScript, or CoffeeScript into JavaScript. It didn't actually have to do any of the hard work. I wrote one that transpiled from emoji into valid Ruby syntax, so you could write entire programs. So yeah, I'm like you, right, is what I'm saying. But like I said at the top, like you see things coming. You saw multi-core performance coming as being the most important thing when no one else was doing it, at least in our Ruby community. And then I had a conversation with you in like summer of 2022, like when you were actively, like, I was like, what are you working on right now? He's like, well, I've dropped everything to make Elixir basically AI first language, like make it very easy to be used in AI context by producing all these hooks and the like data structures and all this stuff in the core parts. And I was like, wow. And you nailed all of the predictions and all the things you saw coming. And so one of the reasons I want to talk to you, and this is the fix I want to work towards, what are the shortcomings in the tools that we depend on today? Git was invented for use by humans, for example. What quality of life improvements, what sort of innovations, what sort of new classes of tools? When you say people don't have no clue where agents are going, like, where are they going?
Right. So, I mean, it's, we are all like kind of like blindfolded, right? And then trying to feel around the edges and try to see what we are dealing with, which for me, it's something that is very fun. I actually enjoy this process. Like, creating a programming language is a lot of this process. Not, you know, because when you create a programming language, there are so many options, so many design decisions and trade-offs you can take that you need to fury around and then make decisions. And I think that's where we are right now. And the models themselves, they are still changing, right? And they can still change drastically. They have changed drastically in the last 2 years. They may still change drastically in the next 2 years, right? And then we don't know what are the capabilities. So something that are going to emerge from that, right? So something that I've heard people saying is that what we have been doing is that, like, we have a version of an LLM that works today, and then it obviously has limitations, and then we try to add some structure around those limitations, and then the next version comes out, right? And it no longer has that limitations, but now you have built this structure on top of those limitations, which are no longer relevant and actually ends up making the newer versions less flexible, right? So there's so much to change that, you know, it's, so my point when we were thinking about like what, you know, like what is grinding my gears was exactly that. Yeah, like we, it's more like I heard people being stressed about like all stress about the future of their career, right? And so some of my angle is also like, look, we actually don't know where it's going to go. So if you feel stressed, it's still so early that you can get involved as part of the process as well and learn, right? It does not necessarily mean. But answering your question more directly, the thing that I would like to see changing is for us to go back to software engineering techniques and practices and processes and reevaluate them. We made a lot of decisions in how software is developed today based on some market assumptions. Like, look, probably the developer time is the most expensive one, right? So if producing code is the most expensive part, we all ended up around like with this particular process where you do the development and then there's the testing later and the infrastructure and then we are reviewing the code. We all came with like with this set of practices that if we are going to assume, like, as I was saying, like maybe 33%, if we're now producing like 33% more code, that's enough to shuffle things around for us to start putting pressure in other parts of the process. And what does that mean?
Right. When you say 33% fewer or like less work, and what change it has to somebody who's not a programmer, I just want to give this a little bit of context and then I'll let you keep telling me what the future is going to look like. Let's say you go from like 10 people on a team to 7 people on a team. That might not seem like a really big change, or 10 to 6, maybe make the numbers easier. A 10 person team has, if you look, do the math of the handshake problem, that's 10 times 9 divided by 2, I think, number of relationships. So it's 45 relationships that have to be managed from each person to each person. But if you have 6 people on the team, it's 6 times 5 divided by 2, which is only 15. So it's a 33% reduction in effort, but it's a 3x reduction in the communication pathways on the team. And so when you talk about the knock-on effects of even just a 33% increase, like, and again, I'm not a math person anymore. And so like, I'm uncomfortable even saying this with confidence that I did that division correctly. However, it's a much, much larger difference in how communication needs to work to be effective. Now that with 15 connections, you can get everyone in a room, you can form consensus on every decision that matters. On a 10 person team, you can't. And that is a night that alone, that one dynamic changes absolutely everything from like what tools you use, how fast you go, like how much you can rely on shared knowledge and collective code ownership versus rules and governance and you know, automated linters and things like that to apply adherence. And so I just to kind of put that color on it, 33% when Jose says that, it doesn't mean he's saying it's insignificant. It's actually very significant because he understands this dynamic.
Yeah. And, or even looking at the other way, like you keep it as six and now you have six, they are 33% more productive, but because it means that they are now writing more code. Well, now you have the tech leads on that team that are reviewing the code and guiding and giving direction. Well, now they have more code to review, to look at, and more guidance to give. How is that, you know, and that maybe is going to say, okay, now he needs to talk more to the product owner, or maybe you have to grow your QA team. Like, yeah, but that's exactly the point. Like, whatever way you look at it, 33% can cause, like, if you are growing or if you are reducing, it can cause enough, right? Enough disruption that we have to rethink all those things. And I know, like you mentioned Git, so there is the Zed editor. They recently announced that they are rethinking collaboration and Git from the beginning. It's not an area that I have actually thought about. I don't have any ideas on that particular angle, but I know that people are bringing this up as one potential area to address, right? But I think like everything, like, you know, what is, like we were talking about, like what is the process that you build the requirements in your company, right? Like those connections they were mentioning, right? How are you maintaining that today and how that is going to change? About the tests, your whole CI infrastructure, right? Like there are so many things, like what is the process? Like I was talking to Dave Thomas recently, and one of the reasons I said I wanted to talk to him is because I'm kind of like having like those heretic thoughts in my head. And one of them is like, should we bring Waterfall back? Because Waterfall was about like, look, you produce the requirements, right? And then then Dave, he clarified like, look, actually what people implemented was Waterfall was not what was in the Waterfall paper, but it was, look, we're going to discuss a lot the requirements first, and then we are going to break it down. And then like we have this process outlined where we talk about requirements, we talk about the system level design, and then we implement it. That's Waterfall, right? Like maybe now it's the time, you know, like maybe Waterfall is like four decades ahead of its time, right? So that's kind of like what I'm thinking. Like, and we see people saying things like, look, typed languages are going to be better with a type system. We don't have any with coding agents. We don't have evidence if they are better or worse at the moment, right? There is even a study from Tencent recently about programming languages and coding agents. And the two languages on top were actually Elixir and C Sharp, which is hilarious because like one is functional and is dynamic, the other is object-oriented and static, right? Like which conclusions are you going to draw from that, right? So yeah, so I think like we need like to go back like to software engineering, look at all those things and say, hey, what works, what doesn't work, what was too expensive before, but can be cheaper now. Like we have this thing called formal methods where we can build models about our system and how they work. And they were kind of expensive to write, to maintain. But maybe AI can make that cheaper. And wouldn't it be great if one of the outcomes of AI is that we are actually using more formal methods in our day-to-day to prove that our systems are correct? So that's where my head is.
I'm going to throw some ideas. Because you, whenever I chat with you, I always come, like, my brain explodes with creative possibilities. And so I wrote down a whole bunch of them. I think fundamentally you just mentioned Waterfall. I was going to mention Agile. I attended a workshop by Michael Spade. He's like an Agile coach. This is 2010 maybe. And he drew a glacier on the whiteboard and the water line, you know, so you only see the tip top. And he said, the top is the activities. This is the stuff that you do at work. This is the behaviors people demonstrate, the actions that you take at work. underneath the waterline are two more levels of the glacier, and no one really sees those. The next one down are your principles. These are the things that are like, you know, they are a level down. They inform the actions that you take. Like a principle might be, I practice test-driven development for all of my code. A principle might be, I pair program all of my code. These are things that are based on the context, the market situation, the type of the problem domain that you're working in. And then underneath that, the bottom layer of the glacier are your values. And your values basically, regardless of whether you're a programmer or an auto mechanic, don't change. These are like, we act with integrity. We believe in an open and honest communication. We treat other people with respect. We put the client and their needs first. Whatever those values are, like, you know, those things are immovable. And what I liked about the Agile moment, right, was that it was such a period of volatility in the market, in the industry, that people were open to actually inspecting the lower layers of the glacier. We were suddenly having conversations about, maybe we need to swap out the principles because things are changing. And when you talk about what's the future of agents, because everyone's attention is on this and because these tools can move so fast, I genuinely believe that there can be multiple right answers. Because you have some people going in a direction and they're building tools that entire websites you can go to build an app, like a whole self-contained, you know, REPL it and other websites. You never write any of the code. The app platform just sort of becomes this ever-growing thing. That's not my style, right? Because I'm a software developer. It's not your style. But like that might have its own independent kind of growth trajectory and be successful in its own way. It doesn't have to lose for like another tool that is just for programmers to be really, really precise and build really high quality software for that tool to also win. And so when you talk about, Git, for example, like maybe Git isn't the right tool for the job anymore because it's mostly about, it was originally written so that we could have easy to merge email based commit. Like branches, right? Like all, there were no pull requests. It was literally, here's a diff and Git knows how to read those diff attachments and then merge them in after Linus Torvalds gets an email. Things have moved on a lot since then. We've already kind of stressed it by piling up so much other stuff on top of Git. Maybe the right next step for our kind of development with agents is some sort of atomic database of every single action and then a chain of custody or requirements traceability back to what informed that action that is scrutable by a computer, right? As opposed to relying on commit messages and so forth. Are there any other things that jump out to you as opportunities to you know, what was that Rahm Emanuel quote? Like, never let a good crisis go to waste. Like, what would you swap out in the middle of the glacier based on your values right now?
Ooh, can you give me the examples again? What is in the middle?
Well, like a principle, like test-driven development. Yeah, it's like, these are the things that I I've been doing for 20 years because they've been so effective, but I need to discard them now.
I don't know, honestly. That's the thing. But I think finding out is fun. I think finding out is fun. What I like to say, so one of the other things that I say as well is like, today, most of our development process, which again, it may change, but most of our development process is coding, testing, and reviewing. That's what we do most. And we should probably get to a point where we can at least delegate two of those to AI, and then we are responsible for one. And then you can pick which one you want to do for a particular thing. But I don't even think we are there yet, right? Like, the AI is going to write and test all the code. You are going to review it. I still often, if the AI can produce everything 100% correct, that's perfect, but it's often not there yet. Would you be comfortable with a point where AI writes the code and review it? You have automatic review, but you are the one who wrote the tests.
Or what a lot of people are doing, and I've experimented with this too, is I'll have one agent running in one tab, and its job is to write tests, yep. and the other one writes the code, and they kind of are in competition with each other and communicating. That can be interesting. I've had the same kind of dynamic where they do ping pong pairing, where it's like you get to write the text and the next little bit of code, well, whatever. Yeah. I've also, you know, taking advantage of the fact that a lot of the terminal-based editors, like the GPT Pro plan or the Claude Max plan, you can just at Claude or at Codex or even automatically have it perform PR reviews on its own work. Yep. Or have them, you know, red team it with Copilot if you've got a Copilot subscription. And so then it's doing, you know, testing and coding and reviewing, and then you're just kind of the final pass of review. You know, all of that stuff can work, but I think what's maybe in this conversation to me most interesting is to try to imagine like what might come next that isn't part of the overall narrative that like to your point, AI is just writing everything and we're kind of just these babysitters, you know, like for example, as a language designer, your point about C# and Elixir made me think, I think that like Zach Holman and I have been chatting a bunch about how it's only a matter of time for startups to start releasing new programming languages with the claim that this was designed for AI. And I think there are two ways you can do that, and I would love your take on this. Imagine a new programming language that is primarily focused on computer-to-computer communication, sort of like Google Protobufs versus JSON, right? Like Protobufs is binary, it's very, very fast, it's type safe, but it's also inscrutable if you're looking at it. JSON, you know, doesn't have real dates, you know, is like a really, really limited in terms of its expressiveness of types. However, you know, it's very writable, it's handwritable by humans. So that's one way the language could go. It could be basically like this like hook and latch system that kind of doesn't looks like Algol or some crazy language. The other way that it could go is a language designed for maximum expressiveness. And so what if it's a language that's just really, really good at taking human specifications, human needs, human requirements, and then expressing that in code, which is more like a Ruby or an Elixir. And maybe that's actually the best path because that's the hardest thing, right? Is to like talk to the computer and get the computer to understand and translate that into executable instructions. What does that tickle in your brain?
So when I think about this, because there are sometimes the job of a programming language is to talk to the computer. Right. And that's a low level programming language or a system level programming language where, you know, you need to have low level abstractions so you can precisely tell the computer to do something or with more precision than a high level language. Right. And then part of the new effort is like, look, how can we make, and then the other programming languages, the higher level ones is look, it's mostly for communicating between humans. Right. So look, you need a language where I'm going to build the software. Somebody's going to come tomorrow, build on top of what I built, and they can read what I wrote and understand that. Right. So there are those two. And I think it's probably fair to say that most of the software being given the most popular languages are Python and JavaScript that are higher level. They are more on the higher end, which is like human to human communication potentially being a priority. So the question of which programming language, if there's going to be a AI language, it's going to depend on the process. Is the process ultimately that you are reviewing the code? If the process ultimately is that you are the one reviewing the code and you are the human, you are most likely going to be the bottleneck, then we are still going to be optimized for whatever language is best for human-to-human communication. So unless we can change that, I don't see the programming language landscape kind of changing.
I can kind of imagine a two-track system based on what you're saying, where let's say for systems level programming, you know, you're writing a garbage collector, you're writing some thread dispatch thing, or you're doing kernel level stuff that has to handle device drivers. It might be the case, that because there's such a almost at some you go low enough and you're just in like electrical engineering and you're doing science, right? And so maybe for the lower level stuff of just implementing von Neumann architecture and building a computer, having, because it's all executable, it's entirely there. You can create a closed loop of feedback, right? You know, an example of this is AI is just developed, like somebody threw a chip die, an existing processor, and then threw it at an AI optimizer. And like, basically it put all sorts of random shit all over that chip die in a way that a human never would have thought to do. And like doubled its fucking performance. And it's because it's at such a low level that it's got the snake can eat its own tail just recursively forever and ever and ever until it gets a good number. Just like if it's playing Mario or Tetris or something like that. However, so maybe there's a language for that, right? That looks more like the really like almost compiled, not reviewable by humans. And then maybe there's another language up top, because like until we have sentient robots that can walk around and taste and smell and exist in the real world, they can't make sure they can't actually assert that the code is really serving its purpose, that it's generating value, that it's cutting costs, that it's pleasant to use. And they can't interact with the real world. They, as long as they need that meat bag interface of a human, you know, kind of guiding whether that's right track or wrong track, maybe there's a second language that is more expressive and scrutable by humans.
But the question is, for those examples, what is making the agent better? Is it the language or is it the verification?
I think, honestly, that's been my primary struggle with this set of tools ever since, you know, call it like, I don't know, April of this year when I started getting serious about using agents. It's been how much of this is slapdash built on top of this mental model of ChatGPT, right? And not actually like with that chat model of an LLM that's not really, how do you put this? Not formalized in any way, not verifiable. It's just like you're having a conversation and stuff's coming out the other end is what all of the tools that we have are built on. And at every point, what I want to make it more like is like that video game, the thing that plays Mario, the thing that plays Tetris, and have it have a high score and it's working to get that score because it's way easier to min-max that. And if we had that verification, we would have reinforcement learning. And if we had real reinforcement learning, these things would get so much better, so much faster. But we're just, I know people, we see RL get typed a lot in the comments sections, but so far I haven't seen a lot of evidence that these tools are actually moving in that direction.
I want to know, but to me that's to me, like, this is exactly why I am talking. I go back and say software engineering, right? Because it's about finding those parameters, those things should mean max, right? So maybe I'm butchering the definition of software engineering. But for me, like, so I come from engineering, right? And engineering, it's an exact science, except that it isn't. It's all about ranges, parameters, like what makes this thing acceptable, right? Like, how can we measure this thing? How can we model this thing? How can we build this thing that fits certain parameters so we're happy with it, right? So you need all those things. You need to be able to model, you need to be able to measure, you need to be able to define what are the boundaries that you are happy to, right? Because if you have those things, then we can let the agent do whatever it does. And then the language is not going to matter. If at some point, you know, you say, look, we don't need to look at it anymore because we have the, it can smell, it can taste. We know it's going to produce something that smells 90% good. We are happy with that. We don't care how, right? So, but yeah, I think I don't know if it can come up with those numbers for software engineering. I don't know if it can like fully automate it, and if we cannot fully automate it, right? And that's the other thing. Like, so when I was talking to Dave Thomas, he one of the things that he said is that kind of our job has always been to talk to people and get the requirements and understand the system that actually needs to be built, right? So, you know, so and it just turns out that we have to do a lot of coding as part of that process as well, because we get those things and then we translate to code and implement it, right? So maybe yeah, that's was always the job that will always be there, because somebody needs to do that, right? And then we'll always be in the loop.
What? I think that you're right. I think that understanding the problem really, really well and being fluent and able to communicate it, whether to another human or to a computer, has always been the ballgame. That is what we do. And when you first reached out to me to say, hey, we have no idea where we are going with coding agents, I didn't immediately make the connection that I think maybe what you're saying is the fundamental game is exactly the same and doesn't seem to be changing, but people are acting with these agents as if that fundamental has changed.
I think so. I would say that I don't have enough evidence in everything that I've seen so far that it's going to fundamentally change. Yes.
So as a result, it's almost like, and this is, you know, maybe a little self-indulgent, because here we are talking about the high-minded software engineering principles. We're name-dropping people like Michael Feathers and Dave Thomas, who've put a lot of thought into, I think, building your and my ideological foundation. We're fundamentally saying, like, actually, in spite of, like, this technological revolution not only doesn't fundamentally change what really matters, it gives us a new opportunity to make it all about that, right? Like, coding was maybe always a distraction, was always something that was, like, it was necessary drudgery that was a distraction from the real work of shared understanding.
In a way, yes, but if that's the conclusion, I would be pretty sad about that, because I do like coding and I do like the problem solving. I like to say, joking from time to time, just a joke that, you know, I did engineering because I wanted to work with numbers and computers and not people. So if that's where we land, I will be unhappy. Like, the fun part of the job, the problem solving, may go away with that, or the fun part of problem solving. I don't know, right? So, right, but in a sense, it's like, for me, it's more like, you know, like, I think it can have, like, rewarding it a little bit. I think it can still have, like, fundamental impact. As I said, like, the 33%, that's going to be fundamental impact, but I don't think the impact is going to be big to the point where the humans are no longer in the loop, right? And I can concede that maybe in 3 years, our role in the loop may be substantially different than it is today. That's a possibility. But we still don't have indicators, right? Like, we don't have indicators. Like, if we look, like, as I was saying, like, as part of our development process, right? Even when you said, like, look, I can put 3 agents, one for review, one for development, one for testing, you still said, I'm still reviewing the code at the end, right? You're not ready to give that part up, right? So you have to be in the agent. Like, and going back, like, to the knowledge, where are we storing the knowledge, right? Like, that we learn as part of the process of the requirements, right, of the memories. How are we managing that? We don't have answers for that. The tests that AI writes today, they are pretty shit, right? And they are pretty shit because we humans, we have been writing shit tests for decades at this point, and now it has learned all of our shitty tests. So for me, like, unless we solve all those things, right, I don't see where we get to that destination that everybody is talking about. So
what should somebody do? What's the hot fix then? If the problem is we have no idea where we're going, to somebody listening to this, what's the takeaway? And it's got to be podcast title length. So give me a pithy one-liner.
Right. I think one of the possible takeaways is like carve your own destiny, right? It's like it's liberating on the sense that there are a lot of people telling you that it's going to look like this, but it might not. Like they have no idea. I have no idea. Right. So that's why it's very hard for me to say, like, what is going to be the future, because I have no idea. And I am trying to work on the things that matter for me. But it can turn out that in 3 years from now, the things that I thought were important, they are not really important. Maybe, you know, maybe tests are not important.
I think your open handedness, your comfort to hold, you know, something I always respect in people is when they can hold two contradicting opinions or ideas in their head at the same time. And so you can do two things, and you just did. You said, maybe we go down that route and the thing that I think is the fun part of the job goes away. And because you and I are old, that's fine for us. We've mostly run our course at this point. We've had our impact where, you know, like I'm just a retired man of leisure who lives in Florida now. You still have, you know, products to sell. And I'll, before I let you go, I'll ask you to give me a pitch for Tidewave and why I should use it. But I think that the other idea that you said, which is like earlier you were talking, hey, if you're worried about your job, we don't know what the future holds. And as you and I discussed, we identified like half a dozen potential futures based on like new tools that could emerge, new ways of working, what these ramifications, whether you use these savings to have smaller teams or more ambitious same-sized teams. And so I think rather than acting in fear, which tends to just paralyze people and into inaction and retrenchment, where it's like the fun part of my job might go away, so I need to fight really hard against this AI thing, which I think is an unhealthy reaction. It's probably not good for, you know, your cortisol and stress levels. But you give the optimistic view, and this is what I want to propose as the hot fix. Build the future you want, because this is the moment where you can actually make an impact. If you want to have a job where you're doing nothing but problem solving, build the tools that you need so that the human just does the problem solving part. Make the AI do the other shit for you, whatever that might look like.
Yeah, or in the sense that, you know, don't also get stuck with any particular solution or what anybody says that the future is going to be, right? Like keep an open mind, try different things. That could be another hot fix. Like keep an open mind, try different things. In the sense that I was going to follow up, but it just another thought came to my head and I lost both. But yeah, like keep like try the different tools. People are going to come up with different suggestions, different ideas on how to explore. Like even like the whole stochastic parrot kind of thing that people try to talk about AI when they try to like, oh, it's not important, it's just a stochastic parrot. I'm like, look, it's not because something is stochastic. It means that it's useless, right? Like a coin, 50%, right? We can still use it to make decisions when we are a fair coin. We can use it to make decisions when we are truly divided on where to go or to start a soccer match, whatever, right? So look at AI as like, look, maybe it can be 70% good on these scenarios. So I have scenarios where it's like pretty, pretty good. So talking a little bit about Tidewave, we support like we support web frameworks. I can talk more about it soon, but we support different web frameworks. So we support like Phoenix, Rails. We are working on Django, which means that an XJS, which means that we have to support different web frameworks. I write the code in Ruby. Oh, I write the code in Elixir for Phoenix. And then I ask AI to translate it to Ruby, and it does like a pretty solid job. Like I would say more than 80% of the time, it's like perfect, right? Because it got the code that I wrote with the style of tests that I wanted it to write. It just ports it. Sometimes I have to tell it in the prompt. I say, look, you're porting this feature and you're using those tests. You're not like writing. And I have to say, no mocks, please, for the love of God, no mocks. But I have like, and then like, I I fine-tune that process a little bit, and now it's pretty good, pretty good, right? Like, I can just say, hey, port things. I'm like, okay, it's all good. It's done. It runs the tests. It runs the linter. It commits. Perfect, right? But if when I use it to help me with anything, so I'm working also on the Elixir type system, it's 100% useless for that. 100%. So I learned. I'm not going to try. Maybe when GPT-6 comes out or Claude 5, then I can give it a try again. But I know that. So my point is, even it being like a stochastic nature, we have enough flexibility today around prompts, tools, whatever, to say, or even from experimentation, to say, look, I can use this thing reasonably well for this particular kind of problem and make it more productive. And it goes back to the beginning of the conversation, right? Like, if you find the things, like if you use it and it's bad, that's already like very important learning, because you already learned where it sucks, right? So like, use that for to say, look, I'm not going to waste my time on this thing right now, and I'm going to use my time to find where it's productive, right? So that's kind of like, you know, another conclusion of this, like, you know, like, just try it out, but without like the paralyzing fear that, you know, if something doesn't work for you, maybe something else is going to work, and explore those things.
All right. I have a fear now that every episode of this podcast is going to basically end with a hotfix that's like, life is complicated, there are trade-offs, have an open mind, things are nuanced. Some variation of that
sentence. Are you just bringing consultants to the show? Is that it?
oh my God. What have I done? I got to work on that. So I think you're basically right. I can't disagree with any of it. I wanted something saltier, but I think it's fundamentally... if you're okay with it, I'll stick with, you know, build the future you want, because I think that this is an opportunity to build new tools.
It is a builder moment. Yeah.
And people have been so used to leaning back for the last 15, 20 years because web frameworks, like all the ones you named, why can your tool port so easily from one to the other to the other? In part, it's because there is a rich, rich data set of like, well, models and views and controllers. Hump-da-dump-da-dump, and it's like hammering them out on a factory line. Like, this is an opportunity for big, big change. And most people in their careers, unless they're graybeards, have probably never experienced that. And so they might not know that they have permission to be like, fuck it, I'm going to build a brand new way to approach programming, because now's the time to do it before things solidify again.
Yeah, or, you know, I'm going to build something that is not based on tests. This thing is so good, this AI, I think I'm going to repeat myself now for sure. Like, that's the exciting part. Like, we are at a point where we may change enough of the process, right, that we can revisit a lot of the decisions that brought us here, right? So if you ever felt like, oh, I don't know why X has not caught up, right? Like, maybe now it's a good time, like, because maybe now it's going to be enough. Like, that's the other thing. Like, as you said, like, we probably have been quite settled with Git, right? Or with Phoenix, Rails, whatever. We have been settled on those technologies, right? But because we can have this pressure now that may happen, right, it's going to be a good moment for it's going to finally be enough for people to say, okay, we finally have to reevaluate Git. Oh, we finally have to reevaluate test, right? Because otherwise, like, going with the inertia of everything to be very hard, right? Because the inertia that moment was, well, that's what we use, that's where we are, right? So nothing is moving, but now the inertia is like things are moving, right? And everybody is in the hype, right, that things have to change. So yeah, I do think it's a builder experimentation kind of stage.
I agree, and we should wrap because we've gone over the time that you told me that you had for sure, and your time zone's later than mine, I could do this for hours.
No, I can still go. I can still go.
Well, you can go. I don't know how your family feels about it. I think we've beaten this horse dead enough. And before I let you go, though, I definitely want to get you to explain to me why me, a Ruby Rails programmer, who's also, well, you know, for the most part, that's what I'm doing lately. What do I get if I start using Tidewave versus using Claude Code or something?
You already said why you want to use Tidewave. So as you were saying at some point, you were like, look, we want the agent to be able to verify what it builds, right? So we want it to be able to smell or taste things, right? If you're working on a web application, right, there isn't much to taste and to smell there. But one of the things that it does is that it runs in the browser, right? So if you want to verify that your web application is actually running correctly, you need to be able to, an agent needs to be able to work on the web app, right? And then be able to interact with it, understand how it works. It needs to be able to understand, like, when it's looking at this DOM element on the page, how that translates to disk, right? So that's pretty much Tidewave. So we got the Coney agent, we put it in the browser, right? And we integrate it directly with the web framework. So it can do everything that your web framework can do. So for example, a lot of people, a Rails developer, you most likely spend a good amount of time on a repo, right? You have a repo, you can even run, we have like the web console that runs on the browser. But when we give a coding agent, we don't give it access to a repo, right? Like, it's like, okay, you can build the feature, but it doesn't have a repo. It doesn't have a direct access to your database because there is no repo. You can bring like a separate MCP for it to talk to the browser. And I can explain why that's not enough later. Like, but basically all the tools that you use as a web developer, we are not giving them to the agents. And the idea of Tidewave is, look, this is a full stack coding agent. It actually understands everything. We teach it how things map, how to talk to your database, right? And it's just a gem install, right? And you get all those things. And the consequence of that is that you have to be less in the loop as a human, right? Because the agent can build more and verify what it builds. So I can give examples later, but let me shut up for now and you may have a follow-up question.
No, in fact, I think that's enough. I just wanted a snack. I just wanted an app, like a little like amuse-bouche. So people can find Tidewave, because I'm actually interested now, because you're right, I've fought that battle enough times, and the fact that they still can't run REPLs is a great example of like how frustrating it is, because you don't have that reinforcement. I've got to be the one to inspect, does it actually, and you end up writing a lot of throwaway tests or whatever, so I can get some kind of verification. Where can I find Tidewave? Is it tidewave.com or
.ai?
AI. Of course. That's the. Yes, I don't know what country owns AI, or if it's a real new top level TLD. Hopefully it's they don't jack the prices way way up. I imagine a lot of domains there are pretty expensive, and I'm pretty cheap.
Well, I'm just happy that it did not go into the kind of like denies domains. So apparently, like, they released a whole new batch of like TLDs, but some of those, they were like quickly snatched up by bad actors. So if you host anything in them, like some browsers, like they just refuse, whenever accessing something on dot whatever, it's just like, ooh, this may be dangerous, right? So we did have one of the other products that we have, Livebook, we were hosting like a subservice on those different domains, and then people were just reporting issues. And I was like, what is the point then of releasing a new TLD if it's going to be like immediately forbidden by browsers? Because
that sucks. Well, you're not in trouble because lots of startups are using AI. It's tidewave.ai. Check it out. I'm going to check it out after we get off and I edit this and do the uploads and that dance. Jose, it's been wonderful to talk to you. I think before I let you go, let's agree. And I think I like your phrase that it's a time for builders. Can I use that as the hot fix?
I think so, yeah. I gave a presentation at Eruco last week where I talk a little bit, I touch on those topics, more specifically around coding agents and language evolution. And the final slide, it's is like, let's go build the next generation of developer tools. So yeah, I think that's perfect.
And that just happens to be too long to fit in the tiny little podcast now playing widget. So I'll settle for the shorter one. Jose, it's always an absolute pleasure. Of course, next time you're in Florida, let me buy you a drink. Thanks a lot for the time today.
Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
All right. Take it easy, man.